Welcome to the Afropolitan Podcast, hosted by Eche Emole, founder of Afropolitan. On the show, we chat with Afropolitans whose footprints form the foundation of systems dedicated to building the future of a bold and progressive Black community. In each episode, our guests share their working formulas, the hard facts about leaving familiar terrain, embracing the unknown, and staying relevant afterwards. Listen as we extract the blueprints of fearlessness, innovation, and progress.
On today's show, we have Odun Oweniyi. Odun, welcome to the Afropolitan Podcast. How are you?
How are you feeling? Very good, very good.
So let's dive into it real quick. How was the pandemic for you? Not in the sense of what did you learn about yourself during the pandemic last year, especially being on lockdown?
You know, I'm not going to lie to you. I didn't learn anything new. I didn't like anything new. I like my own company and I always have. So the pandemic just kind of reinforced that for me. I was fine, like, for the most part, like, virtually doing everything. So I wasn't, like, you know how everyone was, like, getting cabin fever and all those things? That didn't really happen to me. It was just, it was normal. I mean, it was, like, extended. And I was taking walks, and I lived with my sister at the time. So it was a time to kind of, like, get to know yourself, which I don't think is a particularly bad thing.
Did you feel like everybody was just coming to where you had already been at? Like, you know, when you're the person who you're like, oh, okay, you guys didn't know about this cabin life already, so we're welcome.
I grew up, like, with, like, ADHD and Asperger's, so I usually crave my own company after a while. And people were always confused about, like, how I could go, like, weeks without socializing. And I guess everyone just kind of like arrived there where we all couldn't socialize compulsively. It was like, welcome to my life.
Definitely. So then what are your thoughts about working remotely or working from home? Would you say that's your preferred status?
I think I enjoy working from home. But I also think that in the long run, the model that will work is a hybrid model. Because while virtual is fine, remote is awesome, there's still no discounting human, like, interrelations, physical, right? There's no discounting it.
So then let's dive into your professional career real quick. Can you talk to us a little bit about Push CV and what was the inspiration behind that before we transition to PiggyVest?
Right. Well, I mean, so I graduated from university in 2013, and I was on my way back from, you know, I was on my way back from an interview that in June 2013, and while I was walking in my estate, Sumto, a friend from college, a friend from uni, leaned out of the window and kind of called me in. And then he told me, oh, that they're working on a loyalty platform. It was called Paroles. And he then told me if I want, do I want to join them? And I said, yes. Now I'm like, you know, I'm going to join them. So I joined them as a social media manager initially, and later on moved on to ops. Right. And so we worked on that together. And while we were working on that, like, obviously we get into conversations. We were all friends from university. Some of us started to build a CV rewriting service called CV Flash. Right. And, you know, CV Flash started moving. People started hearing about it. And then a lot of the people on CV Flash started asking him, like, what if you were also forwarding our CVs after writing to employers? Right. So we morphed CV Flash into Push CV. That's the point where I joined him, because I started to help him oversee the actual rewriting of the CVs. So it was kind of an evolution from a CV writing platform called CV Flash into Push CV, which was then a platform that would help you write your CV and forward it to employers. But the final form of that was we looked around and we realized that for every job posting in Nigeria in 2014, there was almost 400 applications.
Wow.
Right. So what that means naturally is that if you as a qualified person applied, and the person was looking through the CVs, and you know, there's this lethargy that comes with looking through many applications.
Yeah.
You get 400 applications for a role, and you look through the first 100 and find relatively decent candidates. The remaining 300 are going straight to the trash.
Yeah.
So what we realized was that that also led to like a bunch of good candidates like not having their CVs seen. They needed to be a better way. So we also again evolved Push CV and rebuilt it into this platform that screened candidates. They will screen that pool of 400 or whatever into a top 50 list, and then send that list in tens. So we'll send you, the employer, the best the top 10. If you don't find from that top 10, we'll send you another top 10. Right. So that way you are looking at the best and most qualified for that job at the time, and people are getting the chances that they deserve. So that's kind of how
it started. So were the companies then paying a service fee for that screening?
So the companies were paying for the screening, and then the potential candidates were paying for a CV write service, and then they were also paying for credits to get their CVs pushed. Yeah. Right. So that's kind of how the model worked at the time. And it was really slow moving, right? And then we had this idea for a growth hack in 2015, where in February 2015, we had 30,000 users. And by May 2015, we had 600,000 users because we did a growth hack. And so it was
What was the growth hack?
We launched a nationwide employment competition, which we called it the Elite Employee Quest. And what we did was we went to meet a bunch of companies and got them to commit to hiring from a special pool that we would create.
Yes.
And then we launched a 4-stage competition where people across the country would start, like, there was a basic screening stage, there was a CV screening stage, there was a professional screening stage, and then there was an interview stage, which was also like the psychometrics testing. And then we'll be forwarding the people who passed through those 4 stages into to employers like the Nigerian Stock Exchange and Union Bank and stuff like that. And it got a lot of attention. It was really cool.
So it's basically like American Idol for employees.
You know, even though we definitely didn't call it that, but yes.
So dude, how are you looking for a social media manager when it feels like that's what you kill at? Because these ideas are like top notch. You know, but I guess it's a bandwidth issue too, because at some point you don't.
It is, it's definitely a bandwidth issue. Like when we launched PiggyVest, I was managing the social media for a while, but I can't remember the last time I logged into our Twitter, for instance.
So then let's transition into PiggyVest. So first, can we tell the users or our listeners what PiggyVest does, and then I wanted to really dive into the philosophy behind how PiggyVest also took over the nation.
Right. I mean, so when we're building Push CV, I feel like it's very important, like, for everyone to realize that we're very impatient people. We're building Push CV. We're building something called 500 Dishes. We're building something called 99 Staff. We're building something called Front Desk, Household. And 500 Dishes, like, found, like, a lot of them found, like, some success initially, but ultimately they failed, right? And we also took this kind of like youthful exuberance into Push CV as well, where after we had that growth hack and saw that like huge growth spike, we hired very fast. And then by the end of 2015, Push CV itself, our prize product, had run out of money. And so we were going into December 2015 thinking, how the hell are we going to figure out 2016? And as it turns out, we were on Twitter, and the three of us are very big Twitter users, myself and my co-founders, when Joshua saw that tweet from the lady who had, a lady had like broken her wooden box in which she had saved 1,000 naira every day. And so that picture and that tweet went viral. Josh brought it to our group chat, right? And we were discussing it back and forth. Joshua believed very strongly that there was a digital product there. And so we said, okay, let's try it out. And by June 14, I think, we had the MVP version of PiggyVest ready to roll. So that's kind of how we transitioned into PiggyVest. while still running Push CV.
So let me pause before we transition, right? I think you're actually one of the, you and Timmy, and I know you and Timmy are friends, right? But
yeah.
There was a time when, I'm a founder myself, but I think I transitioned into entrepreneurship in a more like, oh, you're an entrepreneur, you stay in one lane, this is the lane, this is the company, you live and die by that company, right? And I think for you and Timmy, you're one of the first people, especially in our like age group, who I saw say, hey, we can start multiple companies at the same time. Like, we don't have to finish with one, then transition, and then transition. It's what is that? I guess my question is, where did that mindset start from, first of all? Like, hey, we can have multiple companies or startups running at the same time.
I think that I have my parents to thank for that. And for Timmy too, I think it would be the kind of upbringing that we had, both of us. It's having people around you from when you're young who tell you there's nothing you can do.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, my dad, who is like one of the biggest inspirations of my life, I could go to him now and tell him I'm going to be president of the world, even though there's nothing like that. And he'll be like, yeah, right on. Of course you can. And so like, and then I'll just get started working on it. And so when I was growing up, they didn't set limits.
Yeah.
And so I haven't ever had to live within the world's limits. So I know people say that you can't do this, you can't do this. But yeah. Like, if you're not able to offer compelling reasons why I can't, then, you know, I'm not going to, like, you know, restrict myself to those rules, right? And you know, I also believe that fervently that rules are made for people and not people for rules, so we can change it, right? And I think people who say you can't do too many things at once, in some ways they are correct, but in some ways they're also wrong, because there's a lot to be said for personal limits. Right, I'm not here to tell you that if you do too many things at once, you succeed or you fail. I've just listed a string of companies that we started that failed. But there's always something to also be said for attempting.
So, you know what's funny? Yesterday, I was thinking to myself that, do you know who took the quotes, jack of all trades, but master of none, personally? Jack Dorsey. No, Jack Dorsey.
Oh, I need to. Yes. Jack Dorsey is one of the giant companies out there.
Like, he's like, yo, who says you can't be a jack of all trades? He took that personally, clearly, you know. But it's definitely inspiring. And I think on my end, it's something that I definitely look forward to, like, implementing across the board. Even though I think my own mindset is Afropolitan, I want Afropolitan as an umbrella for everything. Media.
Course.
Events, everything, like, just pack everything inside there. I would just keep it pushing like Virgin. I remember when Piggy Vest started, and then I would look at the growth hacks on your social media page, and I'm assuming that you were behind all of that. It seems like a lot of companies have tried to copy what you guys did, but they've not been able to replicate it. What would you say were some of your gems that you guys implemented in the growth hacking system for Nigeria?
First, I'll say I'm not behind all of them at all, maybe a fraction, but like the entire Piggyvest team is very multi-product team. Like, everyone on the team, like, that's the company culture. Everybody on the team is an idea person. Let's do it like this, let's do it like this, everybody. So when we started Piggyvest, right, we didn't have money. So in that regard, you need to understand that, like, necessity is the mother of all the inventions and growth hacks you see on the page. When we got the idea and then we put it out there, people started using it. We tried to raise money. And everywhere we went, we basically had the doors shut in our faces, like, this is not going to work.
And why is that? Why didn't they see why this would work exactly?
Well, I mean, Piggyvest was the first of its kind. And it's kind of difficult to get people to change how things are being done. What Piggyvest was going to do was essentially change how people were saving. Was going to get people to see that, like, you don't have to lose account maintenance charge every month, you know, and you don't have to withdraw money before it's time to withdraw it. We believe firmly that you can save, right? And there's, like, easier, like, fun ways to do it. But no one could see that. Like, the entire, like, financial system in Nigeria was made for rich people, was made for older people. But like a bunch of Nigerians, like 60% of Nigeria is young people who don't have a lot of money. Where's the financial system for us? That was the idea behind Piggyvest. Right. And people didn't believe that there was a market there, like enough moat there, or that the banks wouldn't just do it and kill us. Understandable as well. So that's kind of how we decided that we got the idea from Twitter. So we're going to go back to Twitter to market this thing. If we got the idea from Twitter, it stood natural to us that the people who first adopted it will also be on Twitter. They made the wooden box tweet go viral. So we went back there. And then we started to leverage, right? And what we realized with Piggyvest was something that's very common, but also somehow not very like leveraged. Every time someone had a good experience on Piggyvest, they would take their phones and talk about it extensively. And so the conversation we started having in the office was, how can we scale this, right? How can we make more people do the like talking for us? Mm-hmm. And so with Piggyvest, we decided to also kind of focus on building a community instead of just building a fintech product. So it became important to us to create great experiences for people and have them talk about it. That's it. That's the growth hack. That's the gem. It's like there's no other secret sauce that I can tell you except the entire team is our entire, like everybody has on their tweet deck, the Piggyvest and Piggybank search, making sure that we don't have people going dissatisfied. It's very important.
Wow.
Experience on the, like it's my Twitter is not just mine. It's also mine and Piggyvest. We're sharing links of dissatisfied customers flying across the company. When you join us, you join that culture. It's very important. So that's kind of how we built it. And that's how we built it from when we were like 3 people to when we were 12 people to now that we're almost 70 people. It's that same thing.
Wow. So then in terms of your hiring practices, because how do you guys source for talent for Piggyvest?
You know, we're strangely laid back about that. So we search for like a lot of like the more corporate traditional roles like finance with recruiters. But for the customer support roles, we look like within our existing community and we take a lot of recommendations as well. So there's hiring pages set up, but there's also a lot that goes on with people just like, you know, Piggyvest is like it's a young product and the founders are very visible people. I'm visible, Joshua's visible, Sumto's visible. Sometimes someone would say, you know, let me just like talk to Ojo about a role in the company. And I'd say, okay, you know what, let's interview this person. And then that person kind of fits and the person resumes. So I don't believe that there is one way to hire. There's a set process that everybody that's getting hired must go through. But the inbounds, we're very flexible about the inbounds.
So obviously you believe in the community strategy, right? But yeah. I believe some companies try to hack that like a software. Can you speak a little bit more to why community is more sticky versus just throwing a community manager at stuff and trying to tell them to figure it out?
I think that community managers are great, but there is something that must make people stay, right? Whether it's like the experience or, and I think the difficulty in like setting out to deliberately build a community versus stumbling into it might be the argument here, right? We didn't set out to say like, we are going to build a community product. We saw it kind of start to happen.
Yeah.
And decided, how about we nurture it? So that, and for me, I think that the best things about the best products is noticing things that started organically and then deciding to grow those. I don't have a lot of experience with saying I am going to build a community. Like so it's really, I am going to build a product that's going to work great for this set of people. And these people love it so much. They are forming kind of their own community already. How do we grow it? So like, and I think that might be the best way to think about building communities. Like, what do people want? How can you provide it for them? They'll come and then you can nurture it.
Awesome. So you're also the co-founder of the women's community, Wine and Wine Nigeria. Could you talk a little bit more about how that came to be?
Yeah, I love doing like women-focused stuff. And one of the things that I realized, like, along with Gami, my co-founder with Wine & Wine, was that a lot of us, like, shared the same frustrations. And apart from Twitter, which is basically an echo chamber of nonsense, there was no central place to kind of, like, to vent.
Yeah.
Or to kind of like just talk to each other, right? In the safety of talking to each other. And so we decided, okay, why, how about we start this thing, right? Let's bring a bunch of women together. Let's have a couple drinks. Let's just talk and see if we can find solutions. And it kind of worked, although the, because it was like really centered around physical meetups, we kind of took a hit in the pandemic, but so far so good.
So I think on that note, can we transition into the NSARS movement?
Sure.
What was your first experience with the SARS operators? And whether it's personally or the first stories that you heard that really shook you?
Honestly, I've been hearing about the SARS operatives on Twitter, like people saying SARS stop them, SARS stop them. Mm-hmm. But it didn't hit close to home until there was a developer who worked at Paystack who was stopped. And like that kind of like shook the tech community, and I started to pay attention to them. But the closest to home it came was last year in 2020, around I think it was around June, July, when my co-founder actually was stopped and extorted of $500,000.
What?
Yeah, he got away safe, but that was a thing. Right.
So they made him open up his phone. I'm assuming went to his bank account.
Yes. They made him open up his phone, went to his bank account, and they took that from him. And we fixed it. We were able to get him his savings back and all of that. Mm-hmm. But that could have been anybody.
Yes.
And anything could have happened.
It's interesting to me because the police also stopped me actually while I was back in Nigeria, right?
Of course.
They literally... we're like, okay, send us 20,000 naira from your account. And I did. And so the next day, I go to contact Zenith to reverse it. And there's no process set up
to do that.
And it would seem like such an easy process to handle. But again, it just goes back to the banks aren't really set up for the common people. Like you said, they're really set up for the ultra elite. And systems in place don't serve the users as they should. But
I think that would just be owed to the fact that processes in Nigeria don't really evolve. And so like it's taking the advent of technology, which moves really fast and like really stops for nothing, to kind of show people that you have to move forward. Yeah. And that's what like most like a fintech company, for instance, we can probably do a better job of tracing the funds and like maybe finding it for you or something. But that's kind of how it is. And so when someone close to me got stopped, I mean, he was unscathed, like no physical damage or anything, but it just like illustrated just how much this was going to get to everybody, right? It will get to everybody. And so that was something that like, and you know, as the tech community, we did try to do something. We wrote letters to the government. We asked for like practical solutions, but nothing came of it, right? Nothing came of it, and everyone just kind of continued as normal. And for a while, things were quiet, and then you know, October happened when the guy in Delta State got shot, and kind of kickstarted the entire movement.
What do you think it was about that particular incident that was the fire spark that was needed for it to explode? Obviously, up until then, people had been getting extorted. There was frustration mounting. But what do you think it was about that particular moment, and especially about the guy in Delta as well?
I would say, I think the guy in Delta was just kind of like, you know, when you add like, when there's like fire burning very slowly and you just add dry leaves onto it and then it just boom. It wasn't that particular incident was different or new. Yes. It was that it was adding to a melting pot of different kinds of frustrations.
And for our listeners, what happened was this young man in Delta, he got robbed. He was driving in his car, right? And he got stopped by the police and they killed him and took the car?
Yes.
Wow. Okay. No, sorry, please go on.
Mm-hmm. You know, that the guy got killed and protests started. And I think it was just more about people being, like, incredulous. Like, we can't keep dying like this. This isn't a fight for, like, basic amenities anymore. It's not a fight for education. It's not a fight to stamp out corruption. It's a fight for something as basic as life itself, right? Like, yes. Even if you're not going to provide all of these things for us, you can leave us alive, right? Exactly. At least to continue the struggle. And I think that kind of, exactly. And I think that kind of boiled over, and deservedly so, right? We still stand by it. And, you know, protests started in different parts of the country, and I think that kickstarted the October movement.
So what was it like at the beginning of the protests? How can you describe to us how the Feminist Coalition came about? And so initially, I'm assuming that you didn't think you were going to be an activist. You've not been in the activist Zim space, but that moment happens, and it seems like people are rising up to the task. Can you walk us through that beginning stage and how you came to create the Feminist Coalition?
So I will say that the Feminist Coalition was created in July 2020, before this. Mm-hmm. And it was created for women-focused projects, mm-hmm. right? It was created for women's rights and safety, financial literacy for women, legislative power for women. We had a goal, we had a mission. We've been set up since. And we were going back and forth on how do we launch, right, into the public space. We were a group of 14 women. We've been having monthly meetings, and it's usually about, like, what should be our first project, how do we launch into the public space. So this was ongoing separately. And honestly, when the protest started, I can't tell you how they started or what was going on because I wasn't as plugged in. I was mostly, like, with the rest of Nigeria joining the struggle from Twitter and amplifying the hashtag, right? The key thing is, unfortunately or fortunately for me, I've never been able to stay away from when I see something wrong happening, not involving myself. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if that's a great trait or is a good trait. We'll find out, like, as life goes on, right? And so what happened was on October 9, mm-hmm. there was a woman who got shot at close range in the mouth.
Wow.
Right. And that video went viral. And my friend, Kemi FK, was mm-hmm. fundraising for her along with someone else. And yeah. I realized I personally then decided, oh, okay, I can probably make a donation. And I did. Right. And thankfully, she's fine. Last update we got was that she got, like, facial, like, reconstruction surgery. And she's doing much better. And but that didn't leave me, right? The donation just didn't feel enough. Because mm-hmm. the next thing that started to, like, come to my mind was, if there's no structure to this entire movement, that is decentralized and that's great, but how do we sustain it? And how do we make sure that the most vulnerable are not, like, hurt during these protests? Mm-hmm. In my own experience, from everything, all the history I've read, when you have a war, like, there's the people fighting the war and there's the collateral damage, right? The collateral damage is almost always women and children. I don't like that. And so I was looking at this and I was like, this is going to be like a massive movement. It's peaceful protest. Yes. But if it devolves into something that we don't like, I think that we are going to suffer still. So I called Dami, my co-founder, and I said that I think that I know we've been deliberating and I know that this is not women focused. I think mm-hmm. that we need to get involved. And I outlined what I thought was a skeletal plan of how we should get involved. And then we took it to the larger team. Mm. To their credit, they kind of saw the point. And that's how Femco came to be involved in the NSAS, like, movement. I'm not an activist. I will still continue to say that. I at best, if I am, then I would be a women's rights activist. Really focused on that. But I don't think that any one of us should be able to see the wrong thing happening that will end up affecting all of us and mm-hmm. just stand by. And so that's kind of what happened. And, you know, again, before Femco came to join the protest, there were mm-hmm. several other organizations that were already working. So we joined basically to say it's time to lend our support. And I know that we didn't get like the outcome that we wanted from like the protests, but I will continue to be grateful for the power that Nigerian youth showed like in those 2 weeks. It's possibly the most powerful demonstration that I've ever seen from our generation. And I don't know how and I don't know when, but I suspect that we'll get an echo of it very soon.
It's not going anywhere for sure. I think with what we saw, and I mean, in this day and age, right, we see so much, there's a lot more information out. So I think it's really, again, about making sure people are aware and understand what's really going on ground as well. So let's transition to the CBN real quick. What are your thoughts on their recent announcements regarding the crypto space and also the investment wealth management funds as well?
Right. I mean, I think that obviously, like, there's no financial services without regulators, right?
Yes.
But the other important thing is the realization for all of us, regulator and operator, mm-hmm. that innovation will always move faster than the rules.
Mm-hmm.
What I believe is that as much as innovation is moving faster than the rules, we all need to make space for having those conversations. I don't think that like rules should be made in isolation. And a lot of that seems to be going around. I think that before we make rules, before we push out regulation, there needs to be round tables. I don't like that like we seem to be adept at forming committees except for the things that actually like affect us. And I think it's important that we are like there doing that, forming like those committees to speak about these things. I think that if we had sat at the table, well, I mean, the crypto players specifically had been invited to the table to have a conversation, there might have been a way for us to like get out of this without an outright ban on cryptocurrency companies having access to banking infrastructure. Because with the way the world is going, whether you like it or not, there is crypto in the future. I don't know whether it will be a main player or a side player. What I do know is that it is going to be a player. And we definitely want to, we want to take advantage of that, right? We should. Like, several, like, companies, several countries, several economies are, like, going to leverage and take advantage of it to move themselves and shoot themselves forward. It's arguably the fastest, one of the fastest appreciating assets right now, right? Mm-hmm. We should be able to take advantage of it. So that's kind of where I stand. I don't think that regulators, like, don't have a place. They definitely do, because they have to protect the rest of the populace. But I think that there is a middle point that we've like not found yet. We should probably look for it.
Definitely. So let's talk about First Check HQ. But let's also talk about your transition from being a founder to now being a VC, right? How was that process for you? And how did you say to yourself, I feel confident enough now to also be a VC and fund other founders? And I assume you'd already been funding founders prior to First Check HQ, but now it's a more formalized structure. I see you're also the co-founder of First Check HQ and Rally Cap Global. So what has that transition been like for you?
The reason, like, Aloha and I started First Check, before that I'd been, like, casually angel investing tiny checks in, like, founders I believed in, is that all the angel investments I'd made before we started First Check were all in like male-led companies, zero females in my portfolio. And every time I'd have a conversation, it would always land at, oh, you know, there's just not enough female founders. I did not like being cast in the role of a unicorn, you know, like, oh, it's just you. It's definitely not just me. That's not true. That narrative is very false. There's very smart women doing very smart, very incredible things, and they deserve a chance, right? Already we've seen like women like Farah of Okra, Temi of Livebank, Honey, right? Like there's Tomilola of Bankly, right? There's women, Yamo at Bamboo, Tito at like Helium Health, but there is more, right? And the way we see like every day, it's kind of normal to see a man being announced as a founder of this funded startup. It needs to become a bit more normal for women to be announced that way too. And so for me, if the problem that people were having was there's not enough pipeline, well then let's go to the bottom, right?
Mm-hmm.
And figure out how we can make that pipeline. That's the idea that Elo and I had for First Check. And so, admittedly, it's an experiment, right? We want to see, is it really true that there are no female founders? I suspect that it isn't, right?
Yes.
And so if we're able to invest in those female founders very, very early, then every other person coming on board to invest in them, like, here is the pipeline all laid out for you, right? Have at them. Let's help these women get to, like, their own $100 million, billion-dollar companies. So that's what First Check aims to do.
Awesome, awesome. Ado, thank you again. Before we go, though, I believe that during the NSAS protest, I don't know if people ever talk about whether they needed therapy after, because it was really a traumatizing experience for a lot of people after it happened. Did you seek therapy after? What would you advise for people to help with, like, dealing with that PTSD?
You know what? I definitely did. If for nothing, for like October 20, I watched that Instagram live, and I don't think I'll ever get that image out of my head. And I definitely needed help making sense of it. And so, I mean, I've been to therapy several times, so I definitely recommend it. That's one of the reasons why some of the funds left over from FEMCO's fundraising effort was also directed at paying tabs down at several mental health institutions to help people who needed people to talk to as well. We collectively went through something, and I think that we also, like, need help to kind of, like, process it. So if you can afford therapy, please get it. And I hope that, like, people who unfortunately can't can also find people to talk to in a kind and empathetic way. There was definitely a lot of help needed there.
Definitely, definitely. Ado, I wanted to thank you again for joining us on the Afropolitan podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I would love to definitely have you back in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Afropolitan podcast. We are building the future of a progressive Black community. To join our community, you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Afropolitan. Be sure to join our Discord and Clubhouse community by clicking on the link tree on our Instagram page. See you on social.